Out the bathroom window to the back porch roof, and then down to the garbage can. You must be really hot stuff, clown, Lauder said, still enjoying it. I could never get her to sneak out from me.
I don't like to brag or anything, clown said, but I know what I'm doing.
Grandma came up behind me in her bathrobe.
What's going on?
Valerie got busted.
No kidding, Grandma said. Good for her.
Morelli shoved his gun under the waistband of his jeans.
I'm going to get my jacket and have Lauder drop me off at home. You'll be okay now. Grandma can stay up with you. Sorry about Monopoly, but you're a really lousy player.
I let you win because you were doing me a favor.
Yeah, right.
I hate to interrupt your breakfast, Grandma said to me, but there's a great big scary-looking guy at the door, and he wants to talk to you. He said he's delivering a car.
That would be Tank. I went to the door, and Tank handed me a set of keys. I looked beyond him to the curb. Ranger had given me a new black CRV, very much like the car that had gotten blown up. I knew from past experience it would be upgraded in every way possible. And probably it had a tracking device stuck in a place I'd never think to look. Ranger liked to keep tabs on his cars and his people. A new black Land Rover with a driver waited behind the CRV.
This is for you, too, Tank said, giving me a cell phone. It's programmed with your number.
And he was gone. Grandma looked after him.
Was he from the rental car company?
Sort of. I returned to the kitchen and drank my coffee while I checked the answering machine in my apartment. I had two calls for my insurance company. The first told me I would be receiving forms by priority mail. The second told me I was canceled. There were three calls of nothing but breathing. I assumed this was the rabbit. The last message was from Evelyn's neighbor, Carol Nadich.
Hey, Steph, she said. I haven't seen Evelyn or Annie, but something funny is going on here. Give me a call when you get a chance.
I'm going out, I said to my mother and grandmother. And I'm taking my stuff. I'm going to stay with a friend for a couple days. I'm leaving Rex here. My mother looked up from cutting soup vegetables.
You aren't moving in with Joe Morelli again, are you? She asked. I don't know what to tell people. What do I say?
I'm not staying with Morelli. Don't tell people anything. There's nothing to tell. If you need to talk to me, you can reach me on my cell phone. I stopped at the door.
Morelli says you should have a security chain put on the doors. He said they're not safe this way.
What would happen? My mother said. We have nothing to steal. This is a respectable neighborhood. Nothing ever happens here.
I carted my bag out to the car, tossed it onto the back seat, and climbed behind the wheel. Better to talk to Carol in person. It took less than 2 minutes to get to her house. I parked and did a survey of the street. Everything looked normal. I knocked once, and she answered her door.
Quiet street, I said. Where is everybody?
Soccer games. Every dad and every kid on this street goes to soccer on Saturday.
So what's weird?
Do you know the Pagarellis?
I shook my head no.
They live next door to Betty Lando. Moved in about 6 months ago. Old Mr. Pagarelli sits out on the porch all the time. He's a widower, living with his son and daughter-in-law. And the daughter-in-law won't let the old guy smoke in the house, so he's always out on the porch. Anyway, Betty said she was talking to him the other day, and he was bragging about how he was working for Eddie Abruzzi. He told Loretta that Abruzzi pays him to watch my house. Is that creepy or what? I mean, what's it to him that Evelyn took off? I don't see what the problem is as long as she makes a rent payment.
Anything else?
Evelyn's car is parked in the driveway. It showed up this morning.
That took some of the wind out of my sails. Stephanie Plum, master detective. I'd driven past Evelyn's car and never noticed.
Did you hear it drive up? Did you see anyone?
Nope. Lenny discovered it. He went out for the paper and he noticed Evelyn's car was here.
Did you ever hear anyone next door?
Only you.
I did a grimace.
In the beginning, there were lots of people looking for Evelyn, Carol said. Soder and his friends, and Abruzzi. Soder would just walk into the house. I guess he had a key. Abruzzi, too.
I looked over at Evelyn's front door. You don't suppose Evelyn's in there now?
I knocked on the door, and I looked in the back window, and I didn't see anyone.
I moved from Carol's porch to Evelyn's porch, and Carol tagged along behind me. I knocked on the door hard. I put my ear to the front window. I shrugged my shoulders.
Nothing going on in there, Carol said. Right?
We walked to the back of the house and looked in the kitchen window. As far as I could tell, nothing had been touched. I tried the knob. Still locked. Too bad the window was repaired. I would have liked to get inside. I did another shrug. Carol and I walked over to the car. We stood 4 feet away.
I didn't look in the car, Carol said.
We should do that, I told her.
You first, she said.
I sucked in some air and took two giant steps forward. I looked in the car and blew out a sigh of relief. No dead people, no body parts, no rabbits. Although, now that I was closer, the car didn't smell all that terrific. Maybe we should call the police, I said. There have been times in my life when curiosity has pushed aside common sense. This wasn't one of them. The car was sitting in the driveway, unlocked, with the keys dangling in the ignition. It would have been easy for me to pop the trunk and peek inside, but I had no desire to do this. I was pretty sure I knew the reason for the odor. Finding Soder on my couch had been traumatic enough. I didn't want to be the one to find Evelyn or Annie in the trunk of Evelyn's car. Carol and I sat huddled together on her porch while we waited for the blue and white. Neither of us was willing to articulate our thoughts. It was too awful to speculate aloud. I stood when the police arrived, but I didn't leave the porch. There were two patrol cars. Costanza was in one of them.
"You're looking white," Costanza said to me. "Do you feel okay?"
I nodded my head. I was afraid to trust my voice. Big Dog was at the trunk. He had it open, and he was standing, hands on hips.
"You gotta see this," he said to Costanza.
Costanza walked over and stood next to Big Dog.
"Cripes!"
Carol and I were holding hands for support. "Tell me," I said to Costanza.
"You sure you want to know?"
I nodded my head, yes.
"It's a dead guy in a bear suit."
The world stood still for a moment.
"It's not Evelyn or Annie?"
"No, I'm telling you, it's a dead guy in a bear suit. Come look for yourself."
"I'll take your word for it."
"Your grandma's going to be real disappointed if you don't look at this. Not every day you see a dead guy in a bear suit."
The EMTs rolled in, and a couple unmarked cars followed close behind. Costanza stretched some tape around the crime scene. Morelli parked across the street and strolled over. He looked in the trunk, and then he looked at me.
"It's a dead guy in a bear suit."
"That's what they tell me."
"Your grandma's never going to forgive you if you don't take a look at this."
"Do I really want to look at it?" Morelli studied the body in the trunk.
"No, probably not."
He walked over to me.
"Who owns the car?"
"Evelyn, but nobody's seen her. Carol said the car showed up this morning. Did you draw this case?"
"Nope,"
Morelli said.
"This is Benny's. I'm just sightseeing. Bob and I were on our way to the park when I heard the call go out."
I could see Bob watching us from the truck. He had his nose pressed to the window, and he was panting. "I'm okay," I said to Morelli. "I'll call you when I'm done here."
"You have a phone?"
"It came with the CRV. Morelli looked at the car.
"Rental?"
"Sort of."
"Shit, Stephanie. You didn't get that car from Ranger, did you?" "No. Wait a minute."
He held his hands up.
"I don't want to know."
He looked sideways at me.
"Did you ever ask him where he gets all these cars?"
He said he'd tell me, but then he'd have to kill me.
Did you ever stop to think he might not be kidding?
He got into his truck, buckled himself in, and cranked the engine over.
Who's Bob?
Carol asked. Bob's the one who's sitting in the truck, panting.
I'd be panting too if I was in Morelli's truck, Carol said.
Benny came over with his pad in his hand. He was in his early 40s and probably thinking about retirement in the next couple years. Probably a case like this made retirement even more appealing. I didn't know Benny personally, but I'd heard Morelli talk about him from time to time. From what I heard, he was a good, steady cop.
I need to ask you some questions, Benny said.
I was getting to know these questions by heart. I sat on the porch with my back to the car. I didn't want to see them haul the guy out of the trunk. Benny sat across from me. I could look beyond Benny and see old Mr. Pagarelli watching us. I wondered if Abruzzi was watching, too.
You know what? I said to Benny. This is getting old.
He looked apologetic.
I'm almost done.
Not you. This. The bear, the rabbit, the couch, everything.
Have you ever thought about getting a different job?
Every minute of every day. But then sometimes the job had its moments.
I have to go, I said. Things to do.
Benny closed his little cop notebook.
Be careful.
That's exactly what I wasn't going to do. I hopped into the CRV and eased around the emergency vehicles blocking the road. It wasn't quite noon. Lula should still be in the office. I needed to talk to Abruzzi, and I was too chicken to do it all by myself. I parked at the curb and barreled through the office door.
I want to talk to Eddie Abruzzi, I said to Connie. Do you have any idea where I might find him?
He has an office downtown. I don't know if he'll be there on a Saturday.
I know where you can find him,
Vinny yelled from his inner sanctum.
He'll be at the track. He goes to the track every Saturday, rain or shine, as long as the horses are running.
Monmouth? I asked.
Yeah, Monmouth. He'll be on the rail.
I looked over at Lula. Do you feel like going to the track?
Hell yeah. I feel lucky. I might do some betting. My horoscope said I was going to make good decisions today. Only thing, you want to be careful. Your horoscope sucked.
This didn't surprise me.
I see you're driving a new car already, Lula said. Rental?
I pressed my lips together. Lula and Connie exchanged knowing glances.
Girl, you're gonna pay for that car, Lula said. And I want to know all the details. You better take notes.
I want measurements, Connie said.
It was a nice day, and the traffic was steady. We were going in the general direction of the shore, and lucky for us, it wasn't July, because in July, the road would be a parking lot.
Your horoscope didn't say anything about making good decisions, Lula said, so I think I'm the one who should be deciding things today. And I'm deciding we should play the ponies and stay far away from Abruzzi. What do you want to talk to him about anyway? What are you going to say to the man?
I don't have it totally worked out, but it'll be along the lines of, fuck off.
Uh-oh, Lula said. That don't sound like a good decision to me.
Benito Ramirez fed off fear. I have a feeling Abruzzi is like that, too. I want him to know it's not working. And I want to know what he's after. I want to know why Evelyn and Annie are important to him.
Benito Ramirez didn't only feed off fear, Lula said. That was just the first part. That was foreplay. Ramirez liked to hurt people, and he'd hurt you until you were dead, or wished you were dead.
I thought about that for the 40 minutes it took me to get to the track. The awful part is that I knew it to be true. I knew firsthand. I was the one who discovered Lula after Ramirez was done with her. Finding Steven Soder was a walk in the park compared to finding Lula.
This is my idea of work, Lula said when I pulled into the lot. Not everybody's got a good job like us. Sure, we get shot at once in a while, but look here. We're not stuck in some crummy office building today.
Today is Saturday, I said. Most people aren't working at all.
Well,
Yeah, Lula said. But we could do this on a Wednesday if we wanted.
My cell phone chirped.
Put $10 to win on Roger Dodger in the fifth,
Ranger said, and he disconnected.
Well?
Lula asked. Ranger, he wants me to bet $10 on Roger Dodger in the fifth.
Did you tell him we were going to the track?
No.
How's he do that?
Lula asked.
How's he know where we are? I'm telling you, he's not human. He's from space or something.
We looked around to see if we were being followed. I hadn't thought to look for a tail on the way down. Probably he has the car monitored, I said. Like OnStar, but his system reports to the Batcave. We followed a tidal wave of people through the gate into the belly of the grandstand. The first race had just been run, and the smell of nervous sweat was already permeating the ticket area. The air was thick with collective angst and hope and the frenzied energy that boils at a track. Lula's eyes were rolling in her head, not sure where to go first, hearing the conflicting call of nachos, beer, and the $5 window.
"We need a racing sheet," she said. "How much time do we got? I don't want to miss this race. There's a horse named Decision Maker. That's a sign from God. First my horoscope, and then this. I was meant to come here today and bet on this horse. Out of my way, you're getting in my way."
I stood in the middle of the floor and waited for Lula to place her bet. All around me, people were talking horses and jockeys, living in the moment, enjoying the diversion. I, on the other hand, wasn't allowed the diversion. I couldn't get my mind off Abruzzi. I was being stalked. My emotions were being manipulated. My security was threatened. And I was angry. I was up to here with it. Lula was absolutely right about Benito Ramirez and his sadistic cruelty. And she was probably right that talking to Abruzzi was a bad idea. But I was going to do it anyway. I couldn't help myself. Of course, I had to find him first. And that wasn't going to be as easy as I originally thought. I'd forgotten how big the area was at the rail, how many people congregated there. The bell sounded to close the windows, and Lula rushed over to me.
"I got it. I just got it in time. We got to hurry up and get seats. I don't want to miss this. I just know this horse is going to win. He's a long shot, too. We're going out to dinner tonight. I'm treating."
We found seats in the grandstand and watched the horses come in. If I'd had my own CRV, there would have been mini binoculars in the glove compartment. Unfortunately, the mini binoculars were now a melted glob of glass and slag, probably compressed to the thickness of a dime. I systematically worked my way through the crowd at the rail, trying to find Abruzzi. The horses took off, and the crowd surged forward, shouting, waving programs. It was impossible to see anything other than a blur of color. Lula was screaming and jumping up and down next to me.
"Go, you motherfucker!" she was yelling. "Go, go, go, you dumb son of a bitch!"
I wasn't sure what to wish for. I wanted her to win, but I was afraid if she won, she'd be impossible with the horoscope stuff. The horses streaked across the finish line, and Lula was still jumping.
"Yes!"
she was screaming.
"Yes, yes, yes!"
I looked over at her. "You won, right?"
"You bet your ass I won. I won big, 20-1. I must have been the only genius in this whole freaking place who bet on that four-legged wonder. I'm going to get my money. Are you coming with me?"
"No. I'm going to wait here. I want to look for Abruzzi now that the crowd is thinning." Chapter 13. Part of the problem was that I was seeing everyone at the rail from the back. Difficult enough to recognize someone you know intimately this way. Almost impossible to recognize someone you've only seen briefly on two occasions. Lula plunked down into the seat next to me.
"You're not gonna believe this," she said. "I just looked into the eyes of the devil."
She had her ticket clutched tight in her hand, and she made the sign of the cross.
"Holy Mother of God, look here. I'm crossing myself. What's with that? I'm Baptist. Baptists don't do this cross shit."
"Eyes of the devil?" I asked.
Abruzzi. I ran right into Abruzzi. I was coming from collecting my money, and I just placed my bet, and I bumped right into him like it was destiny. He looked down at me, and I looked into those eyes, and I almost messed my pants. It's like all my blood turns cold when I look into those eyes.
Did he say anything?
No. He smiled at me. It was awful. It was that smile that's just a slash in his face and doesn't go to his eyes. And then, calm as anything, he turned around and walked away.
Was he alone? What was he wearing?
He was with that Darrow guy again. I think Darrow must be muscle, and I don't know what he was wearing. It's like my brain gets paralyzed when I get 5 feet from Abruzzi. I just get sucked into those creepy eyes.
Lula gave a shiver.
Yeesh,
she said. At least I knew Abruzzi was here, and I knew he was with Darrow. I started working my way through the rail crowd again. I was beginning to recognize people. They tended to go away to bet, but then they gravitated back to their favorite spot on the rail. They were Jersey people, the younger guys dressed in T-shirts and khakis and jeans, the older guys wearing Sansevieria polyester slacks and 3-button knit golf shirts. Their faces were animated. Jersey doesn't hold much back. And their bodies were padded with a good protective layer of deep-fried fish and sausage sandwich fat. From the corner of my eye, I saw Lula make the sign of the cross again. Lula caught me looking at her.
It's a comfort, Lula said. I think the Catholics might have hit on something here.
The third race started, and Lula rocketed out of her seat.
Go, Ladies' Choice! She screamed. Ladies' Choice! Ladies' Choice!
Ladies' Choice won by a nose, and Lula looked stunned.
I won again, she said. There's something wrong here. I never win.
Why did you pick Ladies' Choice?
It was the obvious one. I'm a lady, and I had to make a choice.
You think you're a lady?
Fucking A, Lula said.
This time I followed her out of the grandstand to the window. She was moving carefully, looking around, trying to avoid another meeting with Abruzzi. I was looking around for the opposite reason. Lula stopped and went rigid.
There he is, she said. Over there, at the $50 window.
I saw him, too. He was third in line. Darrow was behind him. I could feel every muscle in my body go into contraction. It was like I was squinting from my eyeballs clear down to my sphincter. I marched over and got right up into Abruzzi's face. Hey, I said. Remember me?
Of course, Abruzzi said. I have your picture in a frame on my desk. Do you know you sleep with your mouth open? It's actually very sensuous.
I went still, hoping not to show emotion. Truth is, he knocked the air out of my lungs, and he sent a stab of revulsion into me that sickened my stomach. I'd expected he'd say something about the photos. I hadn't expected this.
I guess you need to pull these idiot pranks to compensate for the fact that you're not having any success at locating Evelyn, I said. She's got something you want, and you can't get your hands on it, can you?
Now it was Abruzzi's turn to go still. For a single terrifying moment, I thought he was going to hit me. Then his composure returned, and the blood rushed back into his face.
You're a stupid little bitch, he said.
Yep, I said. And I'm your worst nightmare. Okay, it was sort of a hokey movie line, but I've always wanted to say it. And I'm not impressed with the rabbit thing. It was clever the first time when you carted soda into my apartment, but it's getting tired.
You said you liked bunnies, Abruzzi said. Don't you like them anymore?
Get a life, I said. Find yourself a new hobby. And I turned on my heel and stalked off. Lula was waiting at the mouth of the tunnel that led to our seats.
What'd you say to him?
I told him to let it ride on Peach's Dream in the fourth.
The hell you did, Lula said. Not often you see a man turn white like that.
By the time I got to my seat, my knees were knocking together, and my hands were shaking so bad I was having a hard time hanging on to my program.
"Geez," Lula said. "You aren't having a heart attack or anything, are you?"
"I'm okay," I said. "It's the excitement of the horse racing."
"Yeah, I figured that was it."
A hysterical giggle escaped from my mouth. "It's not like a Abruzzi scares me."
"Sure, I know that," Lula said. "Nothing scares you. You're a big, badass bounty hunter."
"Damn right," I said. And then I concentrated on not hyperventilating.
"We should do this more often,"
Lula said, getting out of my car, unlocking the Trans Am. She was parked on the street in front of the office. The office was closed, but the new bookstore in the house next door was open. Lights were on, and I could see Maggie Mason unpacking boxes in the window.
"I had a setback in the last race," Lula said. "But aside from that, I had a very good day. I just let it ride. Next time we could go to Freehold, and then we don't have to worry about running into you-know-who."
Lula drove off, but I stayed. I was like Evelyn now, on the run, no place safe to settle. For lack of something better, I went to the movies. Halfway through the movie, I got up and left. I got into my car, and I went home. I parked in the lot, and I didn't allow myself to hesitate behind the wheel. I got out of the CRV, beeped it locked, and walked straight to the back door that led to the lobby. I took the elevator to the second floor, marched down the hall, and unlocked the door to my apartment. I took a deep breath and stepped inside. It was very quiet and dark. I flipped the lights on, every single light I owned. I walked room to room, avoiding the cootie couch. I went back to the kitchen, removed 6 cookies from the bag of frozen chocolate chip cookies, and put them on a cookie sheet. I popped them into the oven and stood there waiting. 5 minutes later, the house smelled like homemade cookies. Bolstered by cookie fumes, I marched into the living room and looked at the couch. The couch looked fine. No stains, no dead body imprint. "You see, Stephanie," I said to myself, "the couch is okay. No reason to be creeped out by the couch."
"Ha,"
an invisible Irma whispered in my ear.
"Everyone knows you can't see death cooties. Take my word for it, that couch has the biggest, fattest death cooties that ever existed. That couch has the mother of all death cooties."
I tried to sit on the couch, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. Soder and the couch were fixed together in my mind. Sitting on the couch was like sitting on Soder's dead, sawed-in-half lap. The apartment was too small for both me and the couch. One of us was going to have to go. "Sorry," I said to the couch. "Nothing personal, but your history." I put my weight behind one end, and I pushed the couch across the living room into the small entrance foyer in front of the kitchen, out the front door, and into the hall. I positioned it against the wall between my apartment and Mrs. Carwatt's apartment. Then I ran back into my apartment, closed my door, and did a sigh. I knew there were no such things as death cooties. Unfortunately, that's an intellectual fact, and death cooties are an emotional reality. I took the cookies out of the oven, put them on a plate, and carted them off to the living room. I zapped the television on and found a movie. Irma hadn't said anything about death cooties on the remote, so I assumed death cooties didn't stick to electronic devices. I pulled a dining room chair over to the television, ate 2 of the cookies, and watched the movie. Halfway through the movie, the doorbell rang. It was Ranger, dressed in his usual black, full utility belt, looking like Rambo, hair tied back. He stood there in silence when I opened the door. The corners of his mouth tipped slightly into the promise of a smile.
"Babe, your couch is in the hall."
"It has death cooties."
"I knew there'd be a good explanation."
I shook my head at him. "You're such a show-off." Not only had he placed me at the track, his horse had paid off 5-1.
Even superheroes need to have fun once in a while,
he said, looking me over, brushing past me, walking into the living room.
It smells like you're marking your territory with chocolate chip cookies.
I needed something to chase away the demons.
Any problems?
Nope. Not since I pushed the couch into the hall. So what's up? I said. You look like you're dressed for work.
I had to secure a building earlier this evening.
I'd once been with him when his team secured a building. It involved throwing a drug dealer out a third-story window. He took a cookie off the plate on the floor.
Frozen?
Not anymore.
How'd it go at the track?
I ran into Eddie Abruzzi.
And?
We had words. I didn't find out as much as I'd hoped, but I'm convinced Evelyn has something he wants.
I know what it is,
Ranger said, eating his cookie. I stared at him, open-mouthed. What is it? He smiled.
How bad does you want to know?
Are we playing? He slowly shook his head, no.
This isn't play.
He backed me against the wall, and he leaned into me. His legs slid between mine. His lips brushed lightly across my lips.
How bad does you want to know, Steph?
He asked again. Tell me.
It'll get added to the debt.
Like I was going to worry about that now? I was in way over my credit limit weeks ago. Are you going to tell me, or what?
Remember I told you Abruzzi is a wargamer? Well, he does more than game. He collects memorabilia. Old guns, army uniforms, military medals. And he doesn't just collect them. He wears them, mostly when he games. Sometimes when he's with women, I'm told. Sometimes when he's settling a bad debt. Word on the street is that Abruzzi is missing a medal. Supposedly the medal belonged to Napoleon. The story being told is that Abruzzi tried to buy the medal, but the guy who owned it wouldn't sell it. So Abruzzi killed him and took the medal. Abruzzi kept the medal on his desk at his house. He wore it when he gamed, believed it made him invincible.
And this is what Evelyn has? The medal?
That's what I hear.
How did she get it?
I don't know.
He moved against me, and desire skittered through my stomach and burned low in my belly. He was hard everywhere. His thigh, his gun, everything was hard. He lowered his head and kissed my neck. He touched his tongue to the place he just kissed, and then he kissed it again. His hands slid under my t-shirt, his palm heating my skin, his fingers at the base of my breast.
Pay up time, he said. I'm collecting on the debt.
I almost collapsed onto the floor. He took my hand and tugged me toward the bedroom. The movie, I said. The best part of the movie is coming up. In all honesty, I couldn't remember a single thing about the movie, not the name or anyone in it. He was standing close, his face inches from mine, his hand at the back of my neck.
We're going to do this, babe, he said. It's going to be good.
And then he kissed me. The kiss deepened, became more demanding, more intimate. I had my hands splayed over his chest, and I felt the toned muscle under my hands, felt his heart beating. So he has a heart, I thought. That's a good sign. He must be at least part human. He broke from the kiss and pushed me into the bedroom. He kicked his boots off, dropped his gun belt, and he stripped. The light was low, but it was enough to see that what Ranger promised in SWAT clothes was kept when the clothes were shed. He was all firm muscle and smooth, dark skin. His body was in perfect proportion. His eyes were intense and focused. He peeled my clothes off and wrangled me onto the bed. And then suddenly, he was inside me. He once told me that time spent with him would ruin me for all other men. When he said it, I thought it was an outrageous threat. I no longer thought it outrageous. We lay together for a while when we were done. Finally, he ran his hand the length of my body.
"It's time," he said.
"Now what?"
"You didn't think the debt would be paid that easily, did you?"
"Uh-oh. Is this the part with the handcuffs?"
"I don't need handcuffs to enslave a woman,"
Ranger said, kissing my shoulder. He kissed me lightly on my lips, and then dipped his head to kiss my chin, my neck, my collarbone. He moved lower, kissing the swell of my breast and my nipple. He kissed my navel, and then my belly, and then he put his mouth to my... Oh, my God. He was still in my bed the next morning. He was pressed next to me, his arm holding me close. I woke to the sound of the alarm on his watch. He shut the alarm off and rolled away to check the pager that had been placed on the nightstand next to his gun.
"I have to go, babe," he said,
and he was dressed, and he was gone. Oh, shit. What did I do? I just did it with the wizard. Holy crap. Okay, calm down. Let's examine this more sanely. What just happened here? We did it, and he left. The leaving seemed a smidgen abrupt, but then it was Ranger. What did I expect? And he hadn't been abrupt last night. He'd been amazing. I sighed and heaved myself out of bed. I showered and dressed and went into the kitchen to say good morning to Rex. Only there was no Rex. Rex was living with my parents. The house felt empty without Rex, so I packed myself off to my parents. It was Sunday, and there was the added incentive of donuts. My mother and grandmother always bought donuts on their way home from church. The horse kid was galloping through the house in her Sunday school dress. She stopped galloping when she saw me, and her face grew thoughtful.
"Have you found Annie yet?"
"No," I said, "but I talked to her mom on the phone."
"Next time you talk to her mom, you should tell her Annie's missing stuff at school. Tell her I got put in the Black Stallion reading group."
"You're telling another whopper," Grandma said. "You're in the Bluebird reading group."
"I don't want to be a Bluebird,"
Annie said.
"Bluebirds are poopy. I want to be a Black Stallion."
And she galloped away. "I love that kid," I said to Grandma.
"Yep," Grandma said. "She reminds me a lot of you when you were that age. Good imagination. It comes from my side of the family. Except it skipped a generation with your mother. Your mother and Valerie and Angie are Bluebirds through and through."
I helped myself to a donut and poured out a cup of coffee.
"You look different," Grandma said to me. "I can't put my finger on it. And you've been smiling ever since you walked in."
Damn, Ranger. I noticed the smile when I brushed my teeth. It wouldn't go away. "Amazing what a good night's sleep can do for you," I said to Grandma.
"I wouldn't mind having a smile like that," Grandma said.
Valerie came to the table looking morose.
"I don't know what to do about Albert," she said.
"Not got a two-bathroom house?"
"He lives with his mother, and he has less money than I do."
"No surprises there." "Good men are hard to find," I said. "And when you find them, there's always something wrong with them." Valerie looked in the donut bag.
"It's empty. Where's my donut?"
"Stephanie ate it," Grandma said.
"I only had one."
"Oh," Grandma said. "Then maybe it was me. I had three."
"We need more donuts," Valerie said. "I have to have a donut."
I grabbed my bag and hiked it onto my shoulder. "I'll get more. I could use another one, too."
"I'll go with you," Grandma said. "I want to ride in your shiny black car. I don't suppose you'd let me drive."
My mother was at the stove. "Don't you dare let her drive. I'm holding you responsible. If she drives and gets in an accident,
You're going to be the one visiting her in the nursing home.
We went to Tasty Pastry on Hamilton. I worked there when I was in high school. Gave away my virginity there, too. Behind the eclair case, after hours, with Morelli. I'm not sure how it happened. One minute I was selling him a cannoli, and next thing I knew I was on the floor with my pants down. Morelli's always been good at talking the pants off women. I parked in the small lot on the side of Tasty Pastry. The after-church rush was over, and the lot was empty. There were 7 parking slots that went nose in to the red brick wall of the bakery, and I parked square in the middle slot. Grandma and I went into the bakery and picked out another 12 donuts. Probably overkill, but better to have too many than to be donut-deprived. We came out of the bakery, and we were approaching Ranger's CRV, when a green Ford Explorer careened into the lot and came to a screeching halt next to us. The driver had a rubber Clinton mask over his face, and the passenger seat was occupied by the rabbit. My heart went ka-thunk in my chest, and I got a rush of adrenaline. "Run!" I said, shoving Grandma, plunging my hand into my bag to find my gun. "Run back to the bakery!" The guy in the rubber mask and the guy in the rabbit suit were out of the car before it stopped rolling. They rushed at Grandma and me with guns drawn and herded us between the two cars. The rubber mask guy was of average height and build. He was wearing jeans and running shoes and a Nike jacket. The rabbit was wearing the big rabbit head and street clothes.
"Against the car and hands where I can see them,"
the masked guy said.
"Who are you supposed to be?" Grandma asked. "You look like Bill Clinton."
"Yeah, I'm Bill Clinton," the guy said. "Get against the car."
"I never understood that part about the cigar," Grandma said.
"Get against the car."
I backed against the car, and my mind was racing. Cars were moving on the street in front of us, but we were hidden from sight. If I screamed, I doubted I'd be heard by anyone, unless someone walked by on the sidewalk. The rabbit got up close to me.
"That is your rubber, the horrid rubber."
"What?"
"Horrid rubber."
"We can't figure out what you're saying on account of your wearing that big stupid rabbit head," Grandma said.
"Rubber,"
the rabbit said.
"Rubber."
Grandma and I looked over at Clinton. Clinton shook his head in disgust.
"I don't know what he's saying. What the hell's rah-rah?"
he asked the rabbit.
"Her is her."
"Christ," Clinton said. "Nobody can understand you. Haven't you ever tried to talk in that thing before?"
The rabbit gave Clinton a shove.
"Rubber, you fucking over."
Clinton flipped the rabbit the bird.
"Jerk,"
the rabbit said. And then he unzipped his pants and pulled out his wanger. He waggled his wanger at Clinton, and then he waggled it at Grandma and me.
"I remember them as being bigger than that," Grandma said.
The rabbit yanked and pulled at himself and managed to get half a hard on.
"Rugger, grow rugger,"
the rabbit said.
"I think he's trying to tell you this is a preview," Clinton said. "Something to look forward to."
The rabbit was still working it. He'd found his rhythm and he was really whacking away.
"Maybe you should help him out," Clinton said to me. "Go ahead. Touch it."
My lip curled back.
"What are you, nuts? I'm not touching it." "I'll touch it," Grandma said.
"Caw!"
the rabbit said, and his wanger wilted a little. A car turned off the street into the lot, and Clinton gave the rabbit a shot in the arm.
"Let's roll."
They backed up, still holding us at gunpoint. Both men jumped into the Explorer and took off.
"Maybe we should have got some cannoli," Grandma said. "I got a sudden taste for cannoli."
I loaded Grandma into the CRV and drove her back to the house.
"We saw that rabbit again,"
Grandma told my mother.
"The one who gave me the pictures. I think he must live by the bakery. This time he showed us his ding-a-ling."
My mother was justifiably horrified.
Was he wearing a wedding band?
Valerie asked.
I didn't notice, Grandma said. I wasn't looking at his hand.
You were held at gunpoint and sexually assaulted, I said to Grandma. Weren't you frightened? Aren't you upset?
They weren't real guns, Grandma said. And we were in the parking lot to the bakery. Who would be serious about something like that in a bakery parking lot?
They were real guns, I said.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Maybe I'll sit down, Grandma said. I thought that rabbit was just one of those exhibitionists. Remember Sammy the Squirrel? He was always dropping his drawers in people's backyards. Sometimes we'd give him a sandwich after.
The Berg has had its share of exhibitionists. Some mentally challenged, some drunk beyond reason, some just out for a good time. For the most part, the attitude is eye-rolling tolerance. Once in a while, someone drops his drawers in the wrong backyard and ends up with an ass filled with buckshot. I called Morelli and told him about the rabbit. He was with Clinton, I said, and they weren't getting along all that great.
You should file a report.
There's only one body part I'd ever recognize on this guy, and I don't think you've got it in the mug books.
Are you carrying a gun?
Yes. I didn't have time to get to it.
Put it on your hip. It's illegal to carry concealed anyway, and it wouldn't be a bad idea to actually put a couple bullets in it.
I have bullets in it. Ranger put them in. Have they identified the guy in the trunk yet?
Thomas Turkello, also known as Thomas Turkey. Muscle for hire out of Philadelphia. My guess is he was expendable, and better to snuff him than take a chance on him talking. The rabbit is probably inner circle.
Anything else?
What would you want?
A Brutzi's fingerprint on a murder weapon.
Sorry.
I was reluctant to disconnect, but I didn't have anything else to say. The truth is, I had a hollow feeling in my stomach that I hated to put a name to. I was mortally afraid. It was loneliness. Ranger was fire and magic, but he wasn't real. Morelli was everything I wanted in a man, but he wanted me to be something I wasn't. I hung up and retreated to the living room. If you sat in front of the television in my parents' house, you weren't expected to talk. Even if asked a direct question, the viewer had the discretion of feigning hearing loss. Those were the rules. Grandma and I were side by side on the sofa, watching the weather channel. Hard to tell which of us was more shell-shocked.
I guess it's a good thing I didn't touch it, Grandma said. Although, I gotta admit, I was kind of curious. It wasn't real pretty, but it was big toward the end there. Have you ever seen one that big?
The perfect time to invoke the television no-answer privilege. After a couple minutes of weather, I went back to the kitchen and had my second donut. I collected my things, and I headed out. I'm going, I said to Grandma. All's well that ends well, right? Grandma didn't answer. Grandma was zoned out to the weather channel. There was a high-pressure area moving across the Great Lakes. I went back to my apartment. This time I had my gun in my hand before I got out of the car. I crossed the lot and entered the building. I paused when I got to my door. This was always the tricky part. Once I was in the apartment, I felt fairly secure. I had a security chain and a bolt besides the deadlock. Only Ranger could get in unannounced. Either he walked through the door ghost style, or else he vaporized himself like a vampire and slid under the jamb. I guess there might be a mortal possibility, but I didn't know what it was. I unlocked my door and searched through my apartment like the movie version of a CIA operative, skulking from room to room, gun drawn, crouched position, ready to fire. I was crashing open doors and jumping around. Good thing no one was there to see me because I knew I looked like an idiot. The good part was I didn't find any rabbits with their tools hanging out. Compared to rape by the rabbit, spiders and snakes seemed like small change. Ranger called 10 minutes after I got into my apartment.
"Are you going to be home for a while?" he asked. "I want to send someone over to set up a security system."
So, the man of mystery reads minds, too.
"My man's name is Hector," Ranger said. "He's on his way."
Hector was slim and Hispanic, dressed in black. He had a gang slogan tattooed onto his neck and a single tear tattooed under his eye. He was in his early 20s, and he only spoke Spanish. Hector had my door open and was making a final adjustment when Ranger arrived. Ranger gave a barely audible greeting to Hector in Spanish and glanced at the sensor that had just been installed in my door jamb. Then Ranger looked at me, giving away nothing of his thoughts. Our eyes held for a few long moments, and Ranger turned back to Hector. My Spanish is limited to burrito and taco, so I couldn't understand the exchange between Ranger and Hector. Hector was talking and gesturing, and Ranger was listening and questioning. Hector gave Ranger a small gizmo, picked up his tool chest, and left. Ranger crooked his finger at me, giving me the "come here" sign.
"This is your remote. It's a keypad, small enough to hook to your car key. You have a 4-digit code to open and close your door. If the door has been violated, the remote will tell you. You're not attached to a watchdog. There's no alarm. This is designed to give you easy access and to tell you if someone's broken into your apartment so you have no more surprises. You have a steel fire door, and Hector's installed a floor bolt. If you lock yourself in, you should be safe. There's not much I can do about your windows. The fire escape is a problem. It's less of a problem if you keep your gun on your nightstand."
I looked down at the remote. "Does this go on the tab?"
"There's no tab, and there's no price for what we give each other. Not ever. Not financial, not emotional. I have to get back to work."
He stepped away to leave, and I grabbed him by the front of his shirt.
"Not so fast. This isn't television. This is my life. I want to know more about this no emotional price thing."
"It's the way it has to be."
"And what's this job you have to get back to?"
"I'm running a surveillance operation for a government agency. We're independent contractors. You aren't going to grill me on details, are you?"
I released his shirt and blew out a sigh.
"I can't do this. This isn't going to work."
"I know,"
Ranger said.
"You need to repair your relationship with Morelli."
"We needed a time out."
"I'm being a good guy right now because it suits my purposes. But I'm an opportunist, and I'm attracted to you. And I'll be back in your bed if the Morelli timeout goes on for too long. I could make you forget Morelli if I put my mind to it. That wouldn't be good for either of us."
"Yeesh,"
Ranger smiled.
"Lock your door."
And he was gone. I locked my door, and I set the floor bolt. Ranger had successfully taken my mind off the masturbating rabbit. Now if I could just get my mind to stop thinking about Ranger. I knew everything Ranger said was true, with the possible exception of forgetting Morelli. It wasn't easy to forget Morelli. I'd put a lot of effort into it over the years, but had never been successful. My phone rang, and someone made kissy sounds to me. I hung up, and it rang again. More kissy sounds. When it rang a third time, I pulled the plug. A half hour later, someone was at my door.
"I know you're in there," Vinny yelled. "I saw the CRV in the parking lot."
I unlocked the floor bolt, the door bolt, the security chain, and the deadbolt.
"Jesus Christ," Vinny said when I finally opened the door. "You'd think there was something valuable in this rat trap."
"I'm valuable."
"Not as a bounty hunter, you aren't. Where's Bender? I got 2 days to produce Bender, or I pay the money to the court."
"You're here to tell me that?"
"Yeah. I figured you needed some reminding. I've got my mother-in-law at my house today, driving me nuts. I thought this would be a good time to get Bender. I tried to call you, but your phone isn't working."
What the hell? I didn't have anything else to do. I was sitting here trapped in my apartment with my phone disconnected. I left Vinny to wait in the entrance hall, and I went in search of my gun belt. I returned with the black nylon web holster strapped to my leg, and my .38 loaded and ready for quick draw.
"Whoa," Vinny said, clearly impressed. "You're finally serious."
"Right. Serious about not getting porked by a rabbit." We cruised out of the lot with me driving and Vinny working the radio. I turned toward the center of town, keeping one eye on the road ahead and one eye on the rearview mirror. A green SUV came up behind me. He cut over a double line and passed me. The guy in the Clinton mask was behind the wheel, and the big, ugly rabbit was riding shotgun. The rabbit turned and popped up through the sunroof and looked back at me. His ears were whipping around in the wind, and he was holding his head on with both hands.
"It's the rabbit!"
I yelled.
"Shoot him! Take my gun and shoot him!"
"What are you, nuts?"
Vinny said.
"I can't shoot an unarmed rabbit."
I was struggling, trying to get my gun out of the holster, trying to drive at the same time.
"I'm going to shoot him then. I don't care if I get sent to jail. It'll be worth it. I'm going to shoot him in his stupid rabbit head."
I wrenched the gun out of the holster, but I didn't want to shoot through Ranger's windshield.
"Take the wheel,"
I yelled to Vinny. I opened the window, leaned out, and got off a shot. The rabbit instantly retreated into the car. The SUV accelerated and turned left onto a side street. I waited for traffic to pass, and then I turned left also. I saw them ahead of me. They were turning and turning until we went full circle, and we were back on State. The SUV pulled up at a convenience store, and the two men took off on foot around the brick building. I slid to a stop beside the Explorer. Vinny and I jumped from the CRV and ran after the men. We chased them for a couple blocks. They cut through a yard, and they disappeared. Vinny was bent at the waist, sucking air.
"Why are we chasing a rabbit?"
"It's a rabbit who firebombed my CRV."
"Oh, yeah. Now I remember. I should have asked sooner. I would have stayed in the car. Jesus, I can't believe you got off a shot hanging out the window. Who do you think you are, the Terminator? Christ, your mother would have my nuts if she knew you did that. What were you thinking?"
"I got excited."
"You weren't excited. You were berserk."
Chapter 14. We were in a neighborhood of large old houses. Some of them had been renovated, and some were waiting for renovation. Some had been turned into apartment buildings. Most of the houses were on good-sized lots and sat back from the road. The rabbit and his partner had disappeared around the side of one of the apartment houses. Vinny and I prowled around the house, standing still from time to time, listening, hoping the rabbit would give himself away. We checked between cars parked in the driveway, and we looked behind shrubs.
"I don't see them," Vinny said. "I think they're gone. Either they slipped past us and doubled back to their car, or else they'll hold up in this house."
We both looked at the house.
"Do you want to search the house?" Vinny asked.
It was a big Victorian. I'd been in houses like this before, and they were filled with closets and hallways and closed doors. Good houses for hiding, bad houses for searching, especially for a chicken shit like me. Now that I was out in the air, sanity was returning. And the longer I was out walking around, the less I wanted to find the rabbit. "I think I'll pass on the house."
"Good call," Vinny said. "Easy to get your head blown off in a house like this. Of course, that wouldn't figure into the equation for you because you're so freaking nuts. You gotta stop watching those old Al Capone movies."
"You should talk. What about the time you shot up Pinwheel Soba's house? You just about destroyed it." Vinny's face creased into a smile.
"I got lost in the moment."
We walked back to the car with guns still drawn, staying alert to sounds and movement. Half a block from the convenience store, we saw smoke billowing from the other side of the brick building. The smoke was black and acrid, smelling like burning rubber. The sort of smoke you get when a car catches fire. Sirens were wailing in the distance, and I had another one of those parakeet flying away feelings. Dread in the pit of my stomach. It was followed by a rush of calm that signaled the arrival of denial. It couldn't possibly be happening. Not another car. Not Ranger's car. It had to be someone else's car. I started making deals with God. "Let it be the Explorer," I suggested to God, "and I'll be a better person. I'll go to church. I'll eat more vegetables. I'll stop abusing the shower massage." We turned the corner, and sure enough, Ranger's car was burning.
"Okay, that's it," I told God. "All deals are off." Holy crap, Vinny said. That's your car. That's a second CRV you've burned up this week. This might set a new record for you.
The clerk was standing outside watching the spectacle.
I saw the whole thing, he said. It was a big rabbit. He rushed into the store and got a can of barbecue starter fuel, and then he poured it in the black car and lit a match to it. Then he drove away in the green SUV.
I holstered my gun and I sat on the cement apron in front of the store. Bad enough the car was totaled. My bag had been in it. My credit cards, my driver's license, my lip gloss, my defense spray, and my new cell phone were all gone. And I'd left the keys in the ignition, and the keypad to my security system was hooked onto the key ring. Vinny sat next to me.
I always have a good time when I go out with you, Vinny said. We should do this more often.
Do you have your cell phone on you?
Morelli was the first number I dialed, but Morelli wasn't home. I hung my head. Ranger was next on the list.
Yo,
Ranger said when he answered.
Small problem.
No kidding. Your car just went off the screen.
It sort of burned up. Silence.
And you know that keypad you gave me? It was in the car.
Babe.
Vinny and I were still sitting on the curb when Ranger arrived. Ranger was dressed in jeans and a black t-shirt and boots, and he looked almost normal. He glanced at the smoldering car, then he looked at me and shook his head. The head shake was actually more the suggestion of a head shake. I didn't want to try to guess the thought that prompted the head shake. I didn't imagine it would be good. He spoke to one of the cops and gave him a card. Then he collected Vinny and me and brought us back to my apartment building. Vinny got into his caddy and took off. Ranger smiled and gestured to the gun on my hip.
Looking good, babe. Did you shoot anyone today?
I tried. He gave a soft laugh, crooked his arm around my neck, and kissed me just above my ear. Hector was waiting for us in the hall. Hector looked like he should be wearing an orange jumpsuit and leg irons. But hey, what do I know? Probably Hector is a real nice guy. Probably he doesn't know that a teardrop under the eye signifies a gang kill. And even if he does know, it's only one teardrop, so it's not like he's a serial killer, right? Hector gave Ranger a new keypad, and he said something in Spanish. Ranger said something back. They did one of those complicated handshakes, and Hector left. Ranger beeped my door open and went in with me.
Hector's already been through. He said the apartment is clean.
He put the keypad on the kitchen counter.
The new keypad is programmed exactly like the last.
Sorry about the car.
It was just a matter of time, babe. I'll write it off as entertainment.
He glanced at the readout on his pager.
I have to go. Make sure you engage the floor bolt when I leave.
I kicked the bolt into place, and I paced around in my kitchen. Pacing is supposed to be calm.